Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 211, which is, honestly, this is just a random number, but to me, it's a special number, Lon.
It's a real special day. We're sitting in the new table.
Yes.
And the new podcast table.
I've been waiting for this for months.
And you, it's like Christmas morning for you.
I know.
So it's beautiful. It works out perfect. Everything is perfect about it.
Yes. Well, that's what happens when you get to say, I want a table that's exactly this height. I want a table that's exactly this width.
Yep.
With holes that go in exactly this place. And it fits exactly in this room.
Yep.
And we have this light, which I love. This, come on, Lon.
It's beautiful.
Worth it.
It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a really amazing thing. And I was just thinking about it, and I put this together, and I was thinking, like, you know, just a little over 4 years ago, I said, hey, Lon, what do you think about starting a podcast? And you said, go for it.
Yeah, good idea.
And I was like, all right. And so here we are in this room now, and this room is built based on the success of this podcast.
Yeah, now it's fully dedicated. I mean, it's been dedicated to the podcast for a while, but mm-hmm. when we first started the office, we said, oh, maybe we'll do some video editing or have some people in to cut reels and stuff like that.
Right.
No, that's not how it turned out.
Yeah, because we record a lot of podcasts.
So now it is laid out specifically for the podcast, and it's perfect. It's great.
Yeah, and these arms and everything else. I want to give you
have to share pictures.
Oh yeah, we are sharing pictures. So for those of you who want to see what we're talking about, just go to if you go on Facebook and you go look up CG Garage Podcast, our page is there, and we will have pictures of this this cool setup. I want to give huge thanks to Kristen for doing this.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She went out there. She researched all the information. I said, I want a table that does all of this stuff. And she goes, there is no table that does all of this stuff. The best thing we can do is to have a custom-made table. And then when we researched it, we found out that it was actually almost the same price as trying to retrofit a table.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was definitely the best way to go.
And so she found this guy. And he made a table for us. It took a little bit longer, which is, of course, because it's a custom-made table. But this is the best. And they're like, we got these chairs. My feet sit under the table. I can't even tell you because I sit at this table for hours and hours.
This is going to be the longest podcast intro about a podcast room.
I don't care. I just want people to know how happy I am about this. About really, this is the best thing ever. And look, we got shock mounts. I'm knocking the table right now. You can't hear it.
Yeah, you don't know that's happening.
You don't know that's happening. This is the best. I feel like a professional broadcast studio. Yeah, right now.
That's
this,
right.
This is the best thing. All right. Enough about the table. It's a very exciting day, I got to say. Let's talk about Andrew Maximoff.
Amazing. just a great guy. Like, what a smart guy doing some amazing stuff. I could talk to that guy for hours.
Oh, absolutely. And not only can you talk to him about for hours and realize, like, what he's actually doing is probably going to change the way that we interface with computers.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We've all talked about it in theory, right? Like the Minority Report situation or whatever. He's actually doing it and making it actually work as an actual production working system. And I'm impressed.
Yeah. I mean, so it's a perfect use case for AI, right? Like use artificial intelligence to cut out all of the steps that are tedious, that you wish you didn't have to do as a creative person.
Right.
So that you could spend more time being creative.
Right.
And so that's the genius of it is that, you know, his system with Promethean AI, I think it's just a beginning for it too. It's really just sort of a first step.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it is a different way of thinking about creative decision-making. And that's the thing that I think is really brilliant about it, because just to give a little spoiler alert on the podcast, the entire interface of Promethean is literally one dot.
Yeah, it's just a little circle.
It's a circle on your screen. You click on that circle, and you have two choices. You can either say what you want, using your voice, or you can type what you want using written text in case you don't want to actually type.
Right.
Or say things out loud. And that's it. And all the decisions that are being made or done for you are done through that interface. There are no sliders. There's no nothing. That's actually a little bit freaky to a lot of people, but it's brilliant when you see it in action.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. Make me this, and it makes that for you. So really brilliant stuff. The other cool and exciting thing is after you listen to this podcast, he will actually be a guest for us over at Total Chaos.
That's right. It's coming up quick.
Yes, it is.
May 17th and 18th.
With masterclasses on the 16th.
The 16th is masterclass. That's right.
So you have masterclasses on the 16th of May, and then 17th and 18th are talks. And so it'll be a very exciting event happening in Sofia. Tickets are on sale now, although going fast, right?
That's right.
So go check it out. Would love to see you there. Love to hear what you guys have to say about it. And you know, be part of the conversation about the amazing tools that are going on. This is not just about V-Ray, not just about Chaos Group. This is about the future of computer graphics across multiple fields, right?
Yep.
So this is about architecture. This is about production design. This is about visual effects. This is about
pretty much anything you can imagine.
Anything you can imagine. We have a lot of people that are doing some very interesting progressive work in VR, AR, or XR, as they call it, right? So really interesting stuff going on. What else is going on in terms of announcements? Oh, wait. There is V-Ray for SketchUp is the next big thing we announced.
Just out. Yep.
So V-Ray Next for SketchUp, which is a big product for us.
Yep.
There is a lot of stuff going on. So if you are a SketchUp user of V-Ray, definitely check out what we've done in V-Ray Next for SketchUp, right?
Yeah, go download the trial or update. It's huge. It brings all the goodness of Next, you know, the scene intelligence and all the things that we've been working on,
right.
Some simpler interfaces, some really cool ways to navigate through the hierarchy of the SketchUp scene to make that easy. So it's a big, big release.
Right. So a lot of smartness is going into it. Yep. So that's a really good thing.
Perfect segue into Andrew.
Yeah, it is. Absolutely. All right, guys. Please enjoy this fantastic podcast with Andrew Maximov from Promethean AI. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So the first time that I actually really looked into your work was at THU last year, which was really interesting. And I want to sort of get into a little bit of your work, which I think is very, very important because you gave us a very interesting demonstration of all this stuff last week. And that's why we said we really need to have you on the podcast, not only have you on the podcast, but actually be part of Total Chaos, which I'm very excited about as well. You've reinvented, in my mind, the way that interfaces needs to be on the creative side of things. I'm very, very impressed by that. But let's get a little bit as to how you ended up doing what you're doing. Like, what was the journey that you took to get there?
How far do you want to go?
Well, as far back as we can. We've got an hour, and you'll be surprised how much information we can dig out of you in an hour.
No, I'm happy to share. I mean, yeah. I've been happy to share for, you know, as long as I've been in this industry. And that's been one of the more exciting things that I love about this is that everyone's so happy to share. And there's so much knowledge floating around, and everyone sort of lifts everybody up, which is a very humbling to be a part of that in the first place. But yeah, no, I always wanted to make video games. And
okay.
I didn't know if that was a possibility. I'm originally from Eastern Europe, which is Belarus, which is a country there's no game development pretty much.
Right.
And yeah, and I tried to do the proper, like, you know, go to college. I did 1 year of international economy.
Okay.
And then I dropped out because it was just mind-numbingly boring.
Yeah.
And,
I can imagine.
Yeah. And so I went straight to making video games, and I went to Wargaming prior to building World of Tanks.
Wargaming.
Yeah, wargaming.net.
Okay.
It was weird. I was 18, and everyone's joking that the studio was using child labor because I probably didn't even look 18.
Right.
But yeah, so I was there for just about a year, but just enough to kind of pick up on everything and work on World of Tanks for a little bit. So we shipped one game and then started working on World of Tanks.
Right.
And then I left. And it was just, all of this was just like a process of how do I get better as an artist for the longest time.
Sure.
But it was trying to figure out analytically how to do that. And okay. then through that, I got into writing tutorials just mm-hmm. because I was analyzing at all times. I'm like, okay, what did I learn just now?
Right.
And then from that, I was getting into the same side of things on the technical sort of angle where I've written this shader system for a personal project that was basically substance pre-substance. Like you would just feed it a height map in Unreal and it would generate an entire material, it would generate damage, it would generate, all the height-aware cracks and sort of fill with the environmental impact of whatever the sand or moss or snow you had there.
Right.
And it was also based on a grayscale map, meaning we also used gradient mapping there, which wasn't much of a utilized real-time technology, but the idea is you take one gray texture and then you map the values to different colors.
Interesting.
And so you can runtime colorize that. And it was interesting because I made this really big environment that's like the video fly through was like 7 or 8 minutes.
Right.
Just on my own. And I would have never been able to do that have I not come up with like this material system where I just make a sculpt and I just drop it in and everything just works.
Right.
But that was like, oh, I can also do tech. Like it was interesting because it was just like a fun research.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. And from there, I think every studio job that I've had is very interesting because the moment somebody finds out at the game studio that you're an artist who can do tech, you're screwed. Like nobody was going to let you do any art.
It's really?
Like, the tech artist, there's this joke going around, like this little comic of like, there's this girl stranded on an island mm-hmm. and she's like laying out in stone on the beach, like SOS. And then nobody responds, like planes just passing by. Uh-huh. And then she's like, I'm a technical artist. And then you see just like ships and planes just land and send paratroopers and everything.
Right.
It's ridiculously hard to find tech people having looked for and hired, plenty sure. of them later. So that was interesting. So I went to work at another company where I did a bunch of sort of tech art setup for an Unreal 4 project, which was interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up at Naughty Dog where I wanted to focus on art. I got in as a texture artist.
Sure.
And then literally second week, I think I was there, somebody drags me into a meeting and goes, hey, we need a new wind system. Would you write one?
Okay. All right.
And so I did that.
Uh-huh.
But that required a little bit of tooling on Maya's side. I've never seen Python in my life before that. But I was like, okay, I guess we'll figure it out.
Right.
But then from there, the thing that's really important to me that I think I got sort of took away from that experience is Naughty Dog has ridiculously passionate artists and they'll, go out of the way to make...
Oh, they're renowned for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they'll go out of the way to make something amazing no matter the tools.
Right.
And the sad part is, and so that was pretty sort of recently from when I started, one of the artists actually came up to me and told me he's considering leaving the company. And I was like, hey, why is that?
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that he felt like he needed to do the most hard thing professionally that anyone can do artistically, build the most complicated thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not feel that the tools were adequate. He said, I feel like I'm trying to, recreate Michelangelo with a stick.
Okay.
And that emotionally I think drains a lot of people because it's a ridiculously complex problem that we're doing, and I don't think we have a good answer sort of industry-wide. Like we have a lot of interesting ideas, mm-hmm. but there's not a cohesive way to say I just want to be creative and make awesome things, because for any given artist 50 to 70 to 80% of their work time is just dealing with boring technical things that are just iteration upon iteration, redoing the same thing over and over again. But
I think people also look at some of that. I mean, especially veterans look at that as like, this is the only way I know how to work. And that becomes their entire existence was that old way of doing things, right?
Very much so.
And so and what's funny is we're talking about a world of computer graphics and we're talking about the old way of doing things in computer graphics. But that is a very true statement. And I still know a lot of people who are on the interface side of things are There's two schools. There's like the old school guys who basically want the interface and the settings and all the minutiae and technology that they had before because that's how they're used to operating. Oh. And then you have the new people who says, I don't want any more interface. I'm done with this interface. Right?
I can very much relate.
Right. And so, I mean, I know it's very much related towards, you know, where you ended up going, but it is an important part of thing is understanding that, like, hey, you don't need – interface can be reinvented at this point, right?
Very much. I think it's important because it's easy with an interface to sort of just change one for the other, and it's very hard to quantify benefits of an updated interface. And so I think that's something that's been very important to us at Promethean is whenever we, you know, demo the tools to artists, and especially because it's AI, it's in some capacity automation,
right.
You get a lot of people that are skeptical or, you know, I always get the comment about taking everyone's jobs away and stuff like that. And after you take them through the demo and they see how it's built to empower them, how it's everything they're thinking in their head with none of the boring stuff that they have to do, you see people sort of convert and they go, oh, I can do so many amazing things.
Right. And I'm going to get to that in a second, but let's continue that story. So you have this artist who's basically trying to create something, you know, one of your artist friends from Naughty Dog who's trying to create something, and he's like, there's a big limitation towards the tools. So how did it go from there?
I just got into building more tools for the team.
It just
went one after the other of like, hey, let's improve vertex color painting for texture artists. Hey,
sure.
let's try and see if we can add some automated placement of things. Let's see if we can, generate imposters. And that was an interesting tech sort of like on the borderline of shader creation and automation where I've built a lot of the imposter setup, automatic level of details and stuff like that, where we could also just optimize a lot faster for the artist so they can focus on the creative stuff. And then it just kind of snowballed and I ended up kind of repurposing the animation asset library that we had and actually building sort of the first asset browser because the studio never had an asset browser.
Right.
And then from there, I kind of very sort of randomly found out that there was actually a way to trigger some of the game menu commands on the dev kit from Python.
Interesting.
And then from there, it's like, oh, and I built this Windows-based interface for everything DevKit. Because basically, before, if you want to change like the sun direction right in the game, you use your gamepad and go through the menus and find the float values for the XYZ orientation, then you adjust those. And so adding like a widget in Maya where you just rotate this dome and it just like updates lighting in game was like, it was ridiculous. Because I remember doing a demo for the team in one of our awesome tools programmers, Dave, was like sitting next to me and I was showing to, I think it was mostly game designers, of like, here's a color picker that you're running on your desktop and you're changing the color of the sun in on the dev kit. Mm-hmm. And that literally got applause. And Dave like turned to me and was like, do you realize you just got applause for a color picker?
Yeah.
But that, I think that's like indicative of the state of the tools.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say exactly the same thing. It's like the fact that a color picker is so bad that now, like the fundamental way of picking colors has changed to the point that it makes sense. That's how bad it is. Yeah.
That is unfortunate. And that's not to say that, you know, the people out there building tools are not doing their job. Like the problem is so immense and complex.
Right.
And there are so many things to build in a game specifically where these people shouldn't be worrying about how the hell the color picker works. You know,
right.
You have a product to build that has to create value for your audience first and foremost. And so there has to be a support infrastructure there to help these creatives make something awesome. And that's kind of where Promethean was born, is just extrapolating from there. Like we shipped Lost Legacy at Naughty Dog and I was just thinking, okay, how are we going to do this for next generation? Because the exponential growth and complexity makes it borderline impossible to maintain creative ownership, not balloon the teams too much, but also have a profit margin of sorts.
Right.
And so through that, it just, whatever sort of incremental changes I felt like I could introduce, it just never felt like they were good enough. I felt like these people deserved to be helped better.
Right.
And that required more resources, more dedicated people that you could not necessarily get within a single game studio.
Okay. And so this led to you sort of deciding to break off on your own because you had certain ideas that you thought could go beyond what you could offer at Naughty Dog, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, in my 4 years there, I think I took like 9 vacation days, so I had a ton. And they basically forced me to go on vacation after Lost Legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I spent that entire vacation just building the first prototype of Promethean.
Right.
And before it was done, like I had it all functioning. You could build a space just by saying words. And then I applied for a patent. And then I came in to Naughty Dog literally first week after the vacation. I was like, I think I have to go do this other thing. I'm sorry. That's heartbreaking. I was like in tears, but.
Well, yeah, but I'm sure that they understood that you had to do that at to some level. It was something impersonal, right? Nothing against them, obviously.
Of course.
But there's, it's in a, just so I'm going to give people a little bit of a window into my perception of this, and then we can go into detail, but this is how I see it, right? A lot of, you know, it is a way of it's a creation toolkit, right? So it's a tool that you can use to make things, but and it operates within Unreal at this point.
We also have a Maya integration, and all of the others are coming.
Like okay, so there's ways you can use, but for the one I saw was inside of Unreal, but yep. You can do it inside of Maya, etc. What is amazing about it is it is based on a large library of assets that you may have, tons and tons of things. And we'll get into how smart it is about that asset library. But based on it learning, using deep learning and all the stuff that it knows about the asset stuff, what you've been able to do is for it to become a tool where the interface is conversational as opposed to buttons.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So instead of a sea of buttons, the entire interface is a dot. Okay? And I mean this very seriously. The entire interface of Promethean is a dot. When you click on the dot, you have two options. You can just say what you want, or you can, if you don't want to use your voice because it sounds weird when you're in a studio and you keep saying things, you can just start typing things and it will do those things for you too, right?
Yep.
And the big example that you gave us was build me a 1980s nerdy kids room. And you can just type those words out and it will make all the things that it needs to do for you. It places a bed in there, puts posters of ET up there, some Atari console, whatever assets it knows. It knows that all these things belong in the interface. And you can continue to edit it much the way an art director would, as opposed to a carpenter, right?
Yes.
So it's much more like, move this desk here. No, that's, let's get that in a different color. Let's do this. Okay, great. And you can continue to edit things. So how is this possible?
Well, it's a lot of science, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think the interesting part is first realizing that it's necessary in a way,
yes,
which is interesting to me because obviously that's not the angle that's usually sort of this is approached from technically.
Right.
And having the background of actually, you know, building art and art directing and painting and you know, sculpting, mm-hmm. realizing that the implementation and the creative problem solving are actually very separate.
Right.
And there's only a small part of the creative thinking and then a big part of implementation. And so trying to literally remove all of the implementation, figure out how do we make an interface that's literally all about being creative and the creative problem solving and
right.
and realizing all of that. And so I think once that sort of settled in my brain a little bit, that everything else is basically us paying for imperfect technology.
Okay.
And inevitably in the future, that's going to go away because that does not add value.
Right.
Conceptually, neither to the user themselves or to the audience.
Okay.
And so it's all about how do we strip out everything that does not add value? It's all the things that you have to do because you cannot just sort of telepathically tell the technology what you want.
Right.
And so that's what we set out to build. How do we telepathically borderline, you know, have you communicate with your technology? And so, yeah, it's based on AI learning a lot of things from virtual scenes that I have seen before. So it's pre-training. Right. Like that's that entire concept of AI. I mean, there's not a good definition currently, right? Everybody debates what can you actually call AI or not call AI when you go into the models themselves. You know, you have something like linear regression is still technically AI and it's just sort of predicting along a function of what might come out. So
right.
there's like a lot of different mathematical interpretation. But I think for me, conceptually, the most important thing is it's a piece of technology that learns
right.
where you just give it a bunch of data and then from that it can empower itself to have new functionality.
It like, makes it, it enables it to change its decision based on learned behavior.
Yes.
Right?
And so that was the most important part. Like that looking in that space, that what inspired me a lot, because you build a lot of things as an artist. And then the sad thing is you get really proficient at them because you've done them a million times.
Right.
But what that means is you still keep doing them a million and one time and a million and two. Right. And you might not really want to. You can just say, you know, let's do that. Like if you go all the way back, Photoshop used to have these actions where you just record what you did and then have it replay that.
Right.
It's like if that could have been a million times smarter, wouldn't that be great? It's just like do this thing that I did on these thousand images, but apply it to the content and make it sort of contextually, you know, relevant. And so, yeah, that was basically that. But I think the most important part that we're trying to do with this is all of the training that we do is very much sort of artistically curated. Like there's that idea, at least with our initial data set, that we want to build things that are compelling and beautiful. And, you know, we build modules of AI that can comprehend an image visually and reason about composition and color theory and stuff like that. But I think that was also very important because if you look at a lot of like scientific data set and like there's some research that's being done in the space, and we're actually in touch with a lot of the researchers that are working on this, it's based on scientific data sets that are not that great. Like all of the things, like I think one of the biggest ones is, I even forget what it's called, but it's basically like 70,000 of interior spaces pre-made for science. And if you look at it, it's like four walls and a toilet. And it's basically, but that's what scientists have to teach their sort of research on. Like if they're building a, you know, a generative model based on recurrent neural networks, like that's what they go for. And then that's the result we get. And so it's not that compelling, partly because, you know, if you don't have great data in, you don't get great data out. So so that's where we take great focus. And we've been very lucky. We're working with a lot of game studios who've made fantastic games, who've been very kind to just give their entire game to us so that we can train an AI on a proper, you know, award-winning video game and help sort of infuse it with some of that artistic sensibility. And so it's like it's a product very much made by artists for artists, with the artistic sensibilities being at the forefront. And I think that is not just important to me being an artist, but I think that is important because every time you make a product, you have to ask yourself, who's your audience? And then everything's based around that. You can be a programmer, you can absolutely, you know, love ray tracing, and then you've invented a new fancy way of doing it, and then you put a special slider in there, and you're like, oh, that like super scales well. But if that does not directly generate value for the final user, as much as you love that, it might not have a place in the UI. Yeah. You know, it's all of that. It's like, how do you give someone the whole experience? I just want to come in. I want to be creative. I want to build awesome things. I want to feel empowered. And I don't want anything standing in my way as I'm doing that.
Okay.
That's basically the focus.
So it is, and I do want to think, you know, we need to address a few things, because it seems like a lot of people feel, like you said, well, where is the art anymore, right? Have you removed the role of the artist, or all of those different questions that are going to come up? And I'm going to put that in light of, you know, let's assume that yes, this system is trained on, you know, assets from, you know, AAA studios, etc. Now, does your system inherit a bias towards that, which by design, I'm assuming yes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So therefore, does the artist now, are they biased towards that, or is there ways of them to create their own independent look and feel that is biased towards their feeling?
Yes. That is actually a big focus for us, is Promethean is not just a black box with data that we give to you. It is essentially an API that allows everyone to train their own version of AI.
Right.
And something that I'm really excited for with our particular learning algorithm is we can actually sort of keep the labels of who taught it what.
Right.
And then on generation, we can actually bias the generation to the individual style of the person who's using it.
Okay.
And so for all intents and purposes, you as an artist can teach it your own style and then get the AI's interpretation of you back.
Right. So yeah, there was a big option when you were sort of walking through the interface. You were like, you're moving things around. You're doing things that were like, this is better of what I want. And then you said, learn.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like, that's almost like a save state situation, right?
Yeah.
And it's really kind of interesting, but there were so many things that it did really intelligently that I think that the artist could miss, or would be, you know, a lot of minutia. I'll give an example, right? you used the example of creating this bedroom, and you had all the furniture and all these different things, and you had a wall, a door to get into the bedroom, and it automatically put the light switch next to the door. You then decided you're going to move the door to a different location. It moved the light switch with the door because that's usually when you enter a room, the light switch is near the door. So that's just like, yeah, I probably should have known to move the light switch, but it did it for you. You can still move it if you want to, but it was inspired. It's like, oh, if you're going to move the door, let's move the light switch too. So that's good.
That's the hope.
That's the hope, right? So it knows like, oh, you know, this goes with that. Or the other thing is like when you move something on the desk, it moves everything that belongs with the desk, right? And that's the other thing. And it's kind of like automatic grouping, but it's not automatic. It's more like smart grouping. Semantic, right? So really interesting ideas that are an AI system or a machine learning system, no matter what role it has in the creative process, is there to make your life easier and not necessarily take away from what you need to know, right?
Very much so.
Yeah.
I think artistically there is this very simple concept of there's only so many things you care about.
Sure.
As you're building something. And in video games especially, and computer graphics in general, I think we've been preconditioned to kind of caring about everything because we rebuild everything from scratch every time. Mm-hmm. But I think a good example of how that is approached is movies, because when you're making a movie, no matter how imaginative or inventive, you start with a set. You start with a real world location or something you build that, you know, you do not have to make a table from scratch. You do not make a chair from scratch every time for a movie.
Right.
And I think the most important question there, and it's very interesting because that was actually the very first GDC talk that I did all the way back in 2013. It was literally all about when you can do everything from the technical aspect, what you do is going to be the most important question that you're going to have to ask yourself.
Right.
And I think that fundamentally sort of translates into what is the meaning you're trying to assign to a space? Mm-hmm. And that is where you start from. This is like the core, this is the why, and then you radiate from there. But I think conceptually, trying to build software that also just nudges people in that direction, right? Because if you didn't notice something, if, you know, Promethean picked something up for you, or maybe it didn't and it was just left there and you didn't care enough, then that's great.
Okay.
That's also good. The idea is that we want you to express the things that you care about first and foremost, because that's the best I could ever distill our direction to. It's a process of assigning meaning. You constantly go through and you go, this guy is going to have a plaid shirt because whatever, we want to make him seem like a lumberjack or, you know,
sure,
not sort of being too on the nose. But that's the entire process of composing everything. This nightstand is going to be more rounded because this character is supposed to evoke sort of this very kind and personable feeling to him.
Right.
And you don't want to have a lot of sharp angles in the space.
Sure.
It's literally in every single detail you're trying to assign meaning. And then we're just trying to figure out a way of helping you communicate that meaning easier, essentially. And then should you not care about the rest, just like a movie set, well, somebody put a desk there, the director doesn't care, it's fine. And then I really love that. I've seen that video of Ridley Scott on set of the Kingdom of Heaven, and they literally have this like medieval feast.
Okay.
And, you know, and it's fine. He just walks by the set and then he zooms in on like a thing that's in front of the camera, like a candle holder with a mm-hmm. bunch of things. And then he just starts fixing like three candles right in front of the camera mm-hmm. and that's it. But that idea that you get to choose what you pay attention to, because
yes.
right now the cost of production is so big, the cost of iteration is so big that everyone is just scrambling to cover the bases of like a game is gigantic and yeah. they're all racing for like, let's have it be 20 hours, 40 hours. And then nobody gets to polish. Nobody gets to get to 100% of what they're doing yep. because it's always just scrambling to get that content in.
Right.
And so I think what this technology should fundamentally help people do is get that baseline everywhere in a matter of minutes, and then actually have the freedom to choose where do you want to apply meaning and what is relevant to your story.
Okay, absolutely. I want to still address, and we uh-huh. can get to that because I will
sure.
circle back hopefully we can make this all work. I want to address back to those people, a lot of the veterans, remember we were talking yep. about the people who've been doing this for a long time. They have spent the better part of a couple of decades perfecting their skill set in these tool sets, right?
Yep.
They're like, I know every knob and creak and whatever inside of my 3D application,
yep.
and my entire livelihood is based on my knowledge of all of those things. by saying that no, the computer will decide all of that for you seems to counter a lot of those that skill set and may undermine the skills they have honed for the last couple of decades. What is your answer there?
Yeah, no, it's obviously a very important question. It's something we take very seriously. And in fact, in retrospect, I realized that I've been sort of talking about this for the longest time with some of the talks that I did before. They were very much about separating the art part of things from the manual implementation work, sort of like you've referred to a carpenter or something like that. Like there are parts of it that are art and there are parts of it that are craft or maybe even something more mundane.
Okay.
And
there's nothing wrong with craft either. We should keep that in mind. Craft. I mean, the assets that you were using inside of your Promethean are based on craft, right? Someone crafted them, right?
Yeah,
like someone crafted the on set, someone crafted the desk that's there.
Yeah, and it's absolutely important. I think the interesting thing to realize there is, and I used to say that a lot, that there is a difference between sort of specialists and then game developers in a way that I think at some point as we're trying to get better at what we do, we fundamentally have to ask ourselves the question is, where's the value in what we create?
Right.
And I think when you approach it from that angle, realizing that sticking with a particular process because you remember a configuration of buttons is potentially less productive, which means it's detrimental to your ultimate goal of creating a great product.
Right.
And so something that we had at Naughty Dog, and honestly, I hope more studios have, is you're never forced into a particular way of doing things.
Okay.
You have a goal. You can accomplish it however you like.
Right.
And so ideally, as a creative person, you care about that goal, right? You want to make that level the best level possible. You want to make that environment the most beautiful thing ever. And so it should be up to you to choose how you tackle it. But if there's something out there that can give you a 10x speed boost,
right,
and you really care about making something that's going to resonate with your audience, then chances are you're going to take it.
Right.
I think that's where that ties to. And it's interesting because in no way do I want to appear insensitive to that issue.
Okay.
But it's, I think conceptually, right, it's all about the audience. It's always about how do you do something for the people who are going to play your game. And as much as I personally, for example, love modeling, I've spent the last 15 years just moving vertices around, and I realized that might go away. But at the end of the day, the thought that I have in my mind is, even if I love something a lot, it does not automatically mean that other people should financially compensate me for doing that.
Right.
Which is sort of the realization that all of that craft and sort of all of that knowledge that goes into, the perfect edge loops, it's fantastic. And I love that and I miss that. But at the same time, I realize that I cannot go out there to, Joe or Bob or Billy playing a video game and saying, hey, you owe me more money for this game now because I chose to make it this way rather than the other way.
Well, I mean, there's always going to be new ways of doing things that's going to be disruptive, right? I mean, I remember, 20 plus years ago, everyone was creating character models using NURB surfaces and NURB patches,
I remember that.
Right? Which is like, if you think about it today, that just sounds insane. Like why in God's name would you do that? And then people who have done it saying, I still think it was better, blah, 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 blah. It's like, yeah, but it's like saying I'm going to make a character's head by quilting, which is like, you wouldn't do that. You do it by sculpting, right? If you're going to do that, you do it by either modeling clay or you do it whatever. That's how it's been done for 1,000 years or whatever, because that's how volumes work. And therefore, ZBrush came to the top because it said, quilting is not the right way to model characters.
Yep.
But the idea is that, that changed the way that people operate. And obviously that was disruptive in a lot of ways. And look how much better character work has become because of tools like ZBrush that decided to change the interface.
Yep.
I still think that this is the right valid move. The thing that it is, right? So Andrew, I've been thinking about philosophically in the back of my mind what you're doing. And first of all, this actually works. This really works. It's not just like, Minority Report situation here. This is a real, this is science fiction come true, is you're getting there and there is that times when I'm sitting there trying to put together a set or whatever, a modeling room, and there's a guy behind me telling us like, no, like move that desk there. Move that. So what you've done is you've removed me from the situation, right? But the guy who really makes the decisions about it now funnily has an interface. They don't have to worry about like knowing how to push this button in Maya or what keystrokes to use for rotation, scale, translate. It's just become much more natural process. I don't think that's a bad thing.
I think something that's very crucial to express here,
okay,
is that video game situation, computer graphics in general, economically, despite all of the sort of absolute value that's being generated, especially in California here, is pretty dire economically.
Okay.
When you look at, you know, I think it was Digital Domain, right, for getting an Oscar for Life of Pi and then literally shutting down.
No, that was Rhythm and Hue.
Rhythm and Hue, sorry. Yeah. There you go. Shutting down next month.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yep.
To me. And the problem is that the productions are just too ridiculously expensive.
Yeah.
Like the fact that somebody has to press 50 buttons instead of one drives the cost, because that's literally, that means 50 times more time,
right,
spent on any given asset. And that is the scary part. So to me, and having, you know, had the privilege to meet artists from all over the world and talk to them about the games they like and what they build and art and things,
right,
I'm 100% convinced that there is more worlds to be built and more stories to be told than we currently have.
Right.
That all of these people who are in this position where somebody just standing behind their back and go and move that toilet to the left, move that toilet to the right,
right,
they themselves have stories to tell. They have worlds to build, because you don't get into this industry if you're not passionate about world building. You don't just go, man, I love UV so much, I want to do that for the rest of my life, you know?
My God.
Right?
But, yeah.
But that's what a lot of this job has been reduced to, because of the growth and complexity. Uh-huh. And I think that what hopefully we can accomplish with Promethean is give that freedom back to creative people to explore art on their own economic terms. Because right now, if you want to build an awesome looking game, you are fundamentally beholden to someone who has $100 million to invest into building a AAA game. You cannot exercise on your passion on your own terms.
Right.
And talking to a lot of my friends at a lot of studios that keep growing and growing in size, they keep lamenting on the fact that their creative ownership is getting eroded over time.
Right.
Because the productions are so big. Now you're just, you know, the person who's placing grass all day or, you know, modeling car wheels for GTA or whatever else. And that is just, to me, seems like such a injustice on a universal scale, because you have these people who wanted to commit their lives to entertaining others through building beautiful things. And then when you get to the reality of it, it's all of this grunt work that is just soul numbing. And to me, that just seems fundamentally unfair. And in some capacity, as you said, there's job security in sort of the complexity of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there is also a lot of fulfillment and a lot of purpose to be found in building amazing things for people where you actually get to express yourself. Because another big part of that, because the games are so expensive, they have to be, you know, everything for everyone.
Right.
Because if your audience is not everyone, you cannot hope to make your money back. You know, these days you can sell 8 to 10 million copies of a game and you still like barely broken even, which is ridiculous. If we can bring that cost down to 1/10 of what it is, you can have smaller teams making very intimate stories that can resonate with a smaller group of people, but they'll resonate much higher.
Right.
You don't have to be everything for everyone. You can be something fantastic for a small group of people. And I think that would be amazing. The world would be so much better for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to sort of round the horn there, because there's you mentioned, you know, big companies that have been, you know, suddenly going bankrupt because they have so much stuff that their inefficiencies are going on in the world. One of the things, and you alluded to this, one of the things that that happens is every time they start a new project, a new game, a new movie or whatever, it's like they're reinventing the wheel every time, right?
Yep.
Oh yeah, let's build a new asset, let's do this, let's do that, et cetera. But there's actually, and it's like, oh, I can't just use that asset because that asset is not exactly the way, and it was using an old model, then we don't do it that way anymore, so I have to do it all over again to do this, and whatever. There's a lot of reasons, but they keep rebuilding the same thing over and over again. How many, you know, copies of the Statue of Liberty are they going to use in their asset library? I don't know, but it's all there. But what they do have is, because let's say in a company like DD has been around for 25 years, they have a massive asset library of stuff. So therefore, that's what I'm getting back. what you showed at Promethean is actually not just a way to take advantage of assets, but it's also an amazingly clever asset library system. So explain that. And because there's people out there like, yeah, I've seen, you know, what Shotgun can do. And I was like, no. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the smartest librarian in the world.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much for the kind words.
Yeah.
Now, it's very much, in order to build something, you have to first comprehend the building blocks.
Okay.
Even before you comprehend the thing you're trying to build.
Right.
And so that's what we set out to do. And we essentially just build this smaller interface that would use computer vision to label your assets.
Okay.
And then we started showing it to game studios. And immediately the response was, this looks so much more convenient than whatever I'm using. Because can we just use that as our asset manager?
Right.
And then we kind of leaned into it. And then it just grew into so many cool, convenient features of just, you know, you can literally just type in things of like, show me all of the things that Bob made yesterday that were green, color green. And right. We're just like, boom, there you go. And then, you know, it's just the ability to...
But it learns on its own. So it already has, you can just give it a bunch of things.
Yes.
And it'll automatically label a lot of it for you.
Yes.
You can continue to edit those labels if you'd like to.
Yes.
But it'll like, yeah, based on everything I know, this is, you know, a Chippendale desk, right?
Yep.
And it does that on its own because it has huge resources to draw from to identify that stuff.
Very much so, yes. And there is every latest technology in the book. You can imagine we're throwing it all in there,
right,
to make the most informed decision possible for what you're doing. And so there are so many aspects of like everything we've learned about this particular type of asset and its size and its dimensions comes into play, as much as, you know, the computer vision aspect of it, as much as the natural language processing aspect of it. And so
right.
We literally take all of the things into account, and then we do our best to make sure that you don't ever have to do the boring work of labeling assets.
Right. And that's pretty amazing. Do you have a video showing how the asset library works yet?
Not currently.
Okay. You got to get that because I saw the other video that you did, and we'll put that on the podcast link that shows, you know, exactly how the building process works. But the idea of this interface that can classify things based on a number, like, you know, if you're like in the video game thing, it's like, okay, show me all the desks that are under 10,000 polygons, right? Show me all of this or show me all the desks and sort them by polygons. And it'll have a beautiful interface. It's like, oh, I probably want to lean towards this area here because I know my assets are. It's so cool. It's so cool. And I was like, wow, this just... And visually speaking, it just was much more logical because you're so used to just looking at a long list of stuff.
Yep. You know?
Have you thought about this interface for more than just asset stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting. We're talking with companies who do e-commerce and like sell just...
That's exactly what I was getting at. Like if this was the Amazon store, like to literally say, okay, I'm looking for like toys for girls or into $20, whatever it is, like this could be it. Having to go through a long page and hit next, it's a horrible experience.
It is. It very much is a horrible experience.
Wow.
Yeah, it's obviously not our core competence.
Nope.
One of our customers or early adopters that we're working with is in e-commerce, and we approach them from the digital sort of world building aspect, because something you find interestingly in a lot of websites that you visit to buy things for your home, for example.
Sure.
Most images are actually 3D rendered with V-Ray. And put up there.
Yep.
And whatever you think is a picture of an apartment actually isn't.
Nope.
And so there's a gigantic market there for just building virtual spaces at ridiculous scale. Where there's like thousands and thousands of them built a month within every single company.
Yeah,
most of that.
A big portion of the IKEA catalog is rented in V-Ray.
There you go. Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. But like talking to some of these companies and showing them that UI, they just go, oh, can I like label it with like what's in stock and what the price is and like just rearrange it based on the geographical book. It's like, yeah, easy.
Right.
In fact, it was literally something I was doing this weekend is I've entirely moved the asset browser to being fully data driven, meaning even for the types of assets that you put in, you can literally throw anything in there. You can throw furniture, you can throw in sound, animation, any arbitrary attribute that you have. And then Promethean will just visualize it as long as it's, you know, a number.
Wow.
And so it can literally do anything in that regard, which is interesting because we don't have that much resources to go and explore, like, hey, let's build an Amazon sure. for this. But it's something that we are very much hoping is going to become standard as far as just presenting data to people.
Right. Well, this is what I was kind of getting at, because I think that what you guys have is, I mean, obviously it's very interesting as a creation tool set. That's great. But I almost look at your creation tool set as a demo of what it is. You know what I mean? Because there's so much, you're rethinking the way that you interface with a computer. Correct me if I'm wrong, but technically, couldn't you basically start to work with Promethean to create a script?
Very much so.
Right? So instead of actually writing a script from scratch, you can say, all right, let's start. It's a comedy. It's got this and that and that. I hate to say, because writers are going to go, fuck you, right? But it's going to be something that you can do. But technically, why not? You know, and it can start with that, and then you can write it and rewrite it. Because sometimes doing things from scratch, like it was a dark and stormy night, I don't want to have to type those words, right? Yep.
No, it's interesting. It's fundamentally right. How do we boil down the creative process to what matters? It's all taking it to the fundamentals, and that applies to so many endeavors
right
out there. And it's interesting because we're actually one of our early adopters is a movie company, and we're actually talking about doing something in reverse mm-hmm. where we can have Promethean read the script and then construct the scene based on what it has learned is relevant about the scene.
Right.
Which is very interesting. So imagine a scenario where you can write a book entirely on your own, and then you just feed it to an AI that like builds you an animatic of it. Like you can literally pre-visit as an animated movie
right.
just by writing a book. How cool would that be?
It would be cool, but I think it's scary too. Like I think that's the problem I think that a lot of people have with AI is or machine learning or anything that's going on right now. Everyone's a little bit terrified of it. Everything's terrified of like, is it really created by some reality? Is it going to be more interesting, based on because of what I'm doing? There's a little bit of the problem. I've had this discussion, at THU. I did a panel where we're talking about AI. And the thing is, like, the machine learning process is only going to be able to give you things based on what it has already learned. So it's not – originality is not possible by design. Right.
Yeah, that's fair.
And that's fine but I don't think anyone starts with true original thought.
I don't think there is such a thing.
Right.
In the first place.
Right. And so you already start with a bias and an opinion, even if it's your own. And so machine learning is going to be based on that same bias and opinion that you may have.
I think a movie set to me is the best example to that. I always bring up Blade Runner
because
it was literally shot downtown Los Angeles on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Like that street is still there.
Right.
The buildings are still there. What they did was they took an actual real space with all of the biases that made it what it is, and then they dressed it. They chose what matters, and then they added it to the space. And I think that's the way to look at it. Something that we stress with Promethean is it's not supposed to make 100% final environments for you. It gives you that baseline, 70-80%, so that now you can actually infuse it what is important to you and make it yours and make it exactly how it should be. But just like at a movie set, you don't want to produce every single chair from scratch. You start with a baseline and then you massage and you adjust and you tweak. And a lot of creativity comes out of that process.
Right.
And there's this old joke that I forget where I heard, but I really like it. And it's about a Broadway director who was just about to stage a new play or something. So it's the first rehearsal. He comes in and everyone's just sitting there. And he goes, well, why are you all sitting there? And one of the dancers or whatever goes, we don't know what to do. Well, he goes, we'll do something so that I can change it.
Right.
And I think that's the creative process. The creative process is reacting to your art as you sort of, as much as you mold it, it informs you of what it wants to be through that process. Because then you take it in context and go, oh, you know what would work great here now? Mm-hmm. How about this? Or how about this? And so empowering that process is definitely something that we want to focus on.
Yeah. Well, I think it's brilliant. And I think, honestly speaking, I would love to see a world where we have less buttons, yes. Less sliders. I don't mind a slider here and there, but there is no. I'm all for minimalizing interface and things making decisions for you based on its own education, right? So, we like just not, but Chaos Group, we've been working very hard in V-Ray to basically, there used to be a ton of settings. In fact, the problem, I think, a little bit, you know, not to put a little negative on it, the problem with V-Ray is that those settings are still there. You don't need to actually touch them. They're still there because of legacy and some of our veteran users who refuse to get let go, right? But we don't need that, right? The fact is, V-Ray is much smarter at figuring out where it needs samples than you going in and saying, I need 17 more subdivisions of reflection on this one glass. Like, you shouldn't have to do that. Yep. And so it's much smarter at doing that on its own. So why that interface does not need to be there anymore. And so that's kind of the way I see it. It's like, as you started demoing your stuff, I was like, this is the interface. This is the interface that's going to be the future. And, you know, and everyone's going to look at machine learning and freak out. But I don't think it's a bad thing. I think that the creative process is just going to be much more invigorating, right?
And that is the question, right? When you're talking about the buttons and the sliders, the question that I always come back to is, how does this add value to my core product?
Right.
Right. Does this make the experience of the audience better, the fact that this exists?
Right.
And the more we looked at it, the more we realized that pretty much everything can go. You know, one button's enough. But it's about that creative intent. It's like, how do you keep communicating that creative intent? But something else I think that's very interesting to that conversation, this is definitely very much not a new problem. I remember listening to an audio recording of a shareholder meeting of Apple Inc., I think from 1985 or something like that.
Okay.
And one of the shareholders literally asked the question of why do you need, so after Apple II, I think they were working on Lisa or something like that. And so the question was, why do you even need a more powerful computer? Because Apple II can pretty much do everything anyone would want. Like, is there even a reason why are you continuing to waste money on this?
Right.
That was an actual question from a shareholder. And I think Steve Jobs handled it pretty well because his argument was very interesting. He said that as we're getting these spare technological cycles that we used to spend on functionality, on pushing sort of what the machine can do, we now have these cycles to spare on making it easier for everyone to interact with the machine. Because there are two aspects to efficiency of every system, right? It's sort of it's the output and how much it can produce, but also how many people can interact with it. Because on an absolute scale, right, if you have a system that's extremely efficient and only one person can use it, then it's not really efficient because the absolute value it produces is tiny.
Right.
And so if you can actually make a system that both generates a lot of value but is as widely applicable or accessible to as many people as possible, then all of a sudden you're creating ridiculous amounts of value. And so that's kind of trying to tackle that problem from that angle of like you as a person interacting with V-Ray want to make the most amazing renders, but you also want to make them quick and you want to have a lot of them and you want them to be beautiful. Mm-hmm. So is you fiddling with these knobs actually detracting from that? Because that's the time you could have spent, you know, making it better.
Right.
And that is the question.
Yeah, I think so. The thing is, it's this dilemma for us is those two worlds where the variables are still present, but in my mind they're a legacy, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, what I also have found, let's be specific about, you know, the way ray tracing is working. I'm just using this as an example, but I know it's not the subject of what you're doing, but. Ray tracing now is so complicated and knows so much that actually it's too much for an individual person to know how to do all of that stuff, right? So they need to get away from that process and they need to get away from that idea. And what ends up happening is that there was always a guy or a girl who basically knew the most about V-Ray, and they would basically go and they'd say, okay, this scene is taking too long to render. Okay, there's one person that we've hired that knows how to tweak every subdivision on every material, and it's going to spend about 3 days doing that and then fixing it. Now, the problem is when people actually do that today with our current version of V-Ray, they ended up making the rendering slower than they intended, right? And a lot of times, like, it's really slow. I don't know what to do. And what we do is we literally remove everything that's been done and set it back to default settings and make sure all of the adaptive settings are on, and it ends up being 20 times faster almost every time. And that is a thing that, like, And they're like, but you took away, this is what I did. I did that. I was the person that basically went in and tweaked all these settings. Now that's, you've taken away the value of my job. I was like, is that what you want it to be?
It's an interesting question. And I think it's being raised in society a lot more in general, because there is the question of jobs and people just having jobs. But then the other thing is the quality of a job.
Right.
Which is very interesting, because you want people to have quality jobs. And defining that is very interesting, because, you know, just tweaking adaptive sample sliders.
Right.
Where does that create value? And that's what I always come back to, because it's interesting, because not a lot of workplaces in the first place are built around that idea. And that's very alien to me, because everywhere I work, that's the sort of the drum that I'm sort of blaring or whatever.
Right.
It's always like, why are we doing this? Is the first and foremost question that I'm going to ask everyone every single time, every job interview I've ever, you know, had to interview someone. It's always, why do you want to do this? Why do you want to do this with us?
Right.
And then for every level we're building, it's, why does it have to be this way? And then when communicating it to the artist, it's the same thing. Here's why it has to be a certain way. And then within these constraints, you figure it out. But I think that when you approach that, when you approach your entire company from that angle, when you approach your, business from, here's why we do this, and everything else is just a means to an end.
Right.
Then I think that question becomes a little bit less relevant, as in like, you don't want this to be your job. Your job is to make the most beautiful freaking cinematic possible.
Right.
And then this is just having to do this as a byproduct of trying to make the most amazing cinematic possible.
Sure.
And if we can afford to switch back into that mentality, because I think what happened was the production, they're so expensive that you have to specialize very sort of discreetly to have enough competency, as you said, because so many knobs and sliders make it very hard to anyone to hold in their head. And so you have to specialize because that created value. But the more you specialize, the more you lose the connection with the overall product.
Yeah.
And so the more we can go back to generalizing through better efficient tools, the more I think people start seeing that ownership and that relation to the whole product again.
So this brings me back to the concept of pipeline, right? Because pipeline is based on that that process of specialists that follow along the pipeline, just like an assembly line in a factory, right? So the biggest story, and this is, you know, this is so related to Promethea, and you'll appreciate it. And it's a very old story, so I know this is. Lots has changed since then, and I was not working. Some people I knew who were working on Polar Express, right? So it's a long time ago.
Yeah, I know some people that were. Right?
Okay, so it was a long, long time ago, and the pipeline there was very, very much set up as a process of specialists and tickets, etc. So it was closely resembled what I would call like a car factory, right? Where you start at one end and then it goes through the process and then you get a final shot down the other end, an assembly line process. So they were looking at a shot that involved, a Christmas tree in it. And the director was like, you know, that Christmas tree is really distracting in this shot. There's like too many Christmas balls on that Christmas tree. Can we remove like three balls? It's like, okay, well, which ones do you want to remove? It's like that one, and that one. It's like, okay, great. And it says, when can I see it? It's like, be about a week.
Yep.
Because of the amount of time that it had to go back through that entire process. Now, a tool like Prometheus, when you're like, remove three Christmas balls and it's done.
Yeah, it's literally done.
Right? So, By shrinking what you're doing also, Prometheus, is also to shrink the pipeline down. Yeah?
To allow for better iteration.
Right.
Something that I think is becoming more prominent, also from the technical side, which has been very encouraging. I did this panel in Tokyo for a conference called SEDEC, and we were actually talking about technology and pipelines and stuff like that. And I was really happy to find a lot of agreement from a lot of tech directors and programmers that run studios, because I think before there was this notion that a show or a game is going to look great because, you know, we use the latest rendering tech and, you know, we do the best radiosity or whatever.
Right.
And then that's why the picture is going to look so great. But I think we've reached a certain saturation point where the returns we're getting are getting more and more minimal. Any given time. And I think right now we're in that part of the technical sort of life cycle where iteration can allow you to make things a million times more pretty than the most advanced technology we have today.
Right.
Because as you have great talent and artists, they will adapt, they will art direct to the technical limitations that you have to make it look a lot better than something that's not purposefully art directed, but has, you know, whatever, a million more light rays to simulate per square centimeter of the space.
But if they can get, you're right, I think iteration is going to be really good, especially when you get to the point where you're iterating, not even waiting, seconds, but milliseconds, yes. Right? So as you're moving things, you see everything happening in real time and all those type of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's things paramount. And obviously credit goes to everyone developing real time tech with the real time ray tracing you guys do in real time game engines and stuff like that. That is absolutely paramount for that. But I think the other part that's just critical is, I think we used to have this sort of disconnect with technical people will just set up a pipeline. Right. And then they go, you guys use this, and it has to be that way because the data has to be presented in this format to the system. And the value of our show is that the rendering or whatever is done a certain way so you conform.
Right.
And I think right now there's a slow, gradual realization that's not all the way there, that actually that should not be the way. We should conform the technology to the creative process because it's going to look a lot better if you allow creative people to iterate a lot more and a lot faster.
Yeah.
And so... yeah, it's just not the raw numbers don't work anymore. It's the people that matter.
Absolutely. I mean, the best example I have of that was I was on iRobot and our VFX supervisor, his name was Eric Natch, and he was a miniature DP. So that's where he got his training from that kind of stuff. So he didn't really know much about CG world, et cetera, but he knew a lot about how things need to look. Fantastic visual effects supervisor. But he wanted to know, like, all right, I want to see how you're actually lighting this stuff. And I talk him through the process, like, I move this light, wait, render, wait. And he goes, oh my God, this is horrible. And so his example is like, this is as if I, as a DP, I would go on set and I say, all right, turn off all the lights, move them to where I think they should be, wait about half an hour, turn them on, look at it, go, no, that's not right. Let's turn off the lights, move them where I think I need to adjust them, wait another half an hour, then turn them on and go, nope. And it's like, can you imagine if you had to light a set that way?
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. But okay, we're just about an hour, Andrew, and I want to talk a little bit about, like, you know, you coming to Total Chaos, which I'm very excited about. You get to hang out back in Eastern Europe, in that area of the world, which is a lot of fun. Sophia is beautiful in May, so that's nice. But what are you going to be able to? What do you think you're going to talk about around there?
I think it's going to be about, you know, the building of virtual worlds with AI assistants and what the process looks like. I've been doing a lot of that where I've just been, you know, going around the world talking to studios and companies and doing demos and it's interesting because I think the important part of that work is. Even when sometimes, you know, we don't get the partnership or, you know, it's not directly translates to a business relationship just yet, which is absolutely fine by me. You can see how the transition mentally happens for people, because I think as we start realizing how exciting that future can be, how empowered we can feel, how awesome it can be to build things where you're not hindered by all of these technical limitations, I think it's very much just feeling like a kid again, like that idea of like, oh, I can build everything.
Right.
And I think that is just important, is how do we get people excited about that? How do we show them that that's possible, that exists? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, with hopefully a little bit of time, we'll be able to share it with as many people as we possibly can. And that part, I absolutely like it. Like, just even Promethean aside, if I can get everyone or anyone excited about their job,
right?
If I can get anyone excited about building virtual worlds, then that is fantastic. I couldn't ask for anything more, because that's something that I think we forget is such a gigantic privilege in the first place to have something you love doing. Because a lot of people will go through life and they'll hate their job but we, after a while, we get sort of desensitized to it through like this death by a million paper cuts of imperfect technology that just numbs you to what you do.
And then
your job is no longer, you know, this creative imaginative thing. You're just trying to get through the show and you know, not explode.
Right.
And I think that's where it's important. It's like, no, we can bring it back. You can feel like you used to.
Right.
And if you know, if we just get to invoke that feeling through a presentation, even for a day, I think that's all that matters.
Well, I see this. I mean, there's a certain demo that you guys did online, and it's great. But philosophically speaking, I see this way beyond that. I see it way beyond, you know, visual effects and games. I know that's a good way to start because that's what you're familiar with, so you can present it in that context. But I think that this is any kind of creative decision making will benefit from this idea. And that creative decision making could be even things that are you don't think are creative, like choosing to buy a toy for someone at Christmas. Yep. This interface could help you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, if you know enough data. It's interesting. Something somebody said once, and I forget what that was, but I think conceptually it helped a few more things click for me. But the phrase was that the ideal interface for Google is for any question to give you exactly one answer, but it's the perfect one for you.
Okay, well, let's get to this because this is very interesting. Basically, that is what Alexa and Google Assistant are doing. They're giving you one answer.
They're trying to, yeah.
Right? Which is a huge deal because the entire world of the web is based on SEO, search engine optimization. Yep. And you basically now are no longer fighting for the first page of Google searches. You're fighting for the only result that it gives you. And that is a little bit scarier, though.
It is scary. You want your options, and you should be able to request options, which is something that Promethean obviously allows for, is give me options.
Right.
But I think marketing specifically is a space that has a lot of its sort of dubious moments,
mm-hmm.
I'd say. But at least when it comes to the creative process, sometimes getting an idea, a start, is A, either good enough, or B, is going to give you some very direct things that you can fix about it that's going to help you go faster through that process. So I think just conceptually what the reason I like that quote is just it fundamentally alludes to that core idea that we're all conditioned by the tools that we're introduced to believing that that is the creative process.
Right.
And then being able to separate what's actually of value to something that we are just used to doing is paramount. And there are so many things in our daily life that we don't think about.
Right.
That we're sort of preconditioned by that. Another great example that I really liked is these little stickers on fruit that you get at a grocery store.
Uh-huh.
It's interesting because that you use it didn't used to be the case. Like someone at some point put them on there because before, you know, you'd go to a grocery store in the 50s and you just buy fruit and you don't have to peel off a thing to eat it. And then something had to happen in order to scale that we just introduced that inefficiency on it. And then everybody got so used to it that we don't even pay attention to it anymore.
Right.
And we just, okay, you just peel that thing off. But like what, there's like a million and one equivalents of this in the game development space and the computer graphics. It's like a million inefficiencies that we've introduced for the creative process to account for the technical process.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're trying to like dial that back in and figure out, okay, you know, Google doesn't have to give you a million options because, you know, the analysis paralysis is not necessarily what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just more of that. How can we empower your creative process? How can we help you through it? And I think something that's very important about that is with Google, the inputs are not your own, which is very interesting because mm-hmm. somebody forces that information upon you in a way,
right?
Trying to be useful. With Promethean, the core idea is that you inform the suggestions that you get.
Okay.
And I think that is very relevant because that way you're essentially like, it's like working with a person, right? And that is the interesting part is one of the demos that I did, one of the artists had sort of these concerns of like, well, what if I want the AI to build this thing and then it doesn't really directly understand me and it does it a little differently and I have to correct it and then I have to tell it to do it differently. And you went on sort of being a little bit concerned. And the only thing I had to sort of counter that was, doesn't that sound what you've just described as working with another artist?
Right.
And he immediately like, you could see the swish is like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And I think that's...
How many times have you said, no, that's not exactly what I want? That's why there's a version two.
Exactly.
Otherwise, there's always version one.
Exactly. But I think that's what we're moving this towards, right? Everything right. becomes a little bit more personable, a little bit more humanized. When you're looking at operating systems, you know, the next Windows probably does not want to be a Windows. It wants to be a person. You know, they're introducing the Cortanas and the Alexas and eventually it's going to become virtual and you're going to be in these virtual spaces and mm-hmm. interacting with virtual people. But that's the idea is how do we make technology speak your language? How do we go all the way to the Steve Jobs metaphor of put all of the computing power to making everyone enabled to build these amazing things?
Right.
And yeah, and that's where I think being able to get these options based on the things that you've taught the AI, having it be an expression of yourself, having it be a junior artist to you, the art director, is really fascinating and empowering. Where there's a lot of AI technology that's being talked about where, you know, it's fundamentally replacing parts of the process and it's not giving anything in return
mm-hmm.
to the people whose jobs it potentially affects.
Right.
which is really sad. And there are a lot of social implications, but I think something that's very important to me personally with Promethean is it very much gives back to the people whose jobs it affects, because they are now empowered to do more and be faster. And if, you know, and if they don't want to be at a gigantic game studio, they can go and start a small game studio and they will actually have the resources to be financially, you know, okay doing that.
Right.
Which is important. And I think that, yeah, globally, all the Googles and AIs, there's a lot of very contentious points about them. But I think with Promethean, we're trying to do it as responsibly as you humanly can,
right,
with all of the care taken about the artists, because they're what matters, you know?
Yeah.
Everything else is just a byproduct. If I could help artists better by just, I don't know, cleaning the streets and picking up garbage, I'd do that. Everything else is secondary to that. Is like, how do we figure out a way to make this better for you?
Right. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. So where can people learn more about this stuff, and where can they get more information about it?
Well, there's some on our website.
Mm-hmm.
There's the video that we have. There's some demos to some press interviews that we did that mm-hmm. can shed a little bit more light. And there's going to be this podcast. But other than that, there's not that much. We're going to be revealing more gradually. It's an interesting balance for us because we have to manage resources between actually serving our early adopters and making sure they get the best experience and actually mm-hmm. working on sort of things that we can share publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting to see how we'll walk that line and how much we can reveal. But there's definitely a lot to reveal. I think you can probably attest to that. Somebody I did a demo to said that the trailer that we have on our website is literally 1% of what Promethean
does. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You need a longer. And you need something that shows the power of your asset browser or your asset manager or whatever. Your asset librarian, I'm going to call it. It's amazing.
You should call it
Alexandria or something.
Could be. It's interesting. We're definitely on this ancient Greek sort of.
Yep, exactly.
Angle. It's so, actually the code name for the browser was Athena.
Athena.
Well, yeah, it could be Alexandria at some point. But I'm actually looking forward to Total Chaos and actually doing a presentation where we're actually going to show some of it live.
Oh, great.
And sort of walk people more a little bit through that process. Like that I'm definitely looking forward to.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Andrew, so much for doing this. This has been great.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
And I guess we'll see you in Sofia.
Thank you. Yeah. See you there.